And a very warm welcome to the podcast, Tom Daly. How are you today, Tom?
Very good, thank you. How are you doing?
Wonderful. So let's get this started. Where are you right now on planet Earth?
Right now, I'm in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Okay, hot sounds very fancy. So for anybody who hasn't been to Hot Springs, Arkansas, can you give a kind of a rough overview? If I was to go there on holiday tomorrow or I wanted to live there, what are we talking about? Palm trees? Very warm, very cold.
So it's pretty much right in the middle of the state, and we're the state that's right next door to Texas. Everybody knows where Texas is, for better or worse. So we're right next door to Texas, right in the middle of the state. Generally, it's pretty warm, but not palm trees. It's called the Spa City in Arkansas. It was renowned for the hot springs that I think DeSoto didn't discover. He found a bunch of Native Americans enjoying them, but on behalf of Europe, he discovered it. And then, of course, we decided to build cities around them.
All right, cool. And these springs, I mean, are they natural springs in terms of, are we talking about, are they bubbly?
So they're natural springs, and the water comes out of the mountain. And of course, I'm in the U.S., so we speak everything in terms of Fahrenheit. But I think about 140 degrees Fahrenheit,
Okay.
so it's quite hot.
Right. And have you dabbled in the springs mainly? Are you a springer?
Absolutely. So there's two ways to do it. One's self-destructive, and one is self-indulgent. The self-indulgent way is they've got these historic bathhouses on what they call Bathhouse Row, and you can go in there, and what they'll do is they'll take some of the really hot water and they put it in cooling tanks, and then they take the fresh hot water out of the mountain and mix the two together. So it's hot. You're gonna need to soothe yourself with some little lullaby in your head, but it's tolerable. It's not injurious. The self-harming way to do it is outside. They've got a pool where we just compulsively have to throw coins.
Right.
Well, I've been there with nephews before, and you just roll your sleeve up. Let's see who can grab a coin.
All right. Okay.
I've never been able to grab a coin. I've gotten, elbow deep in water that felt like it was boiling hot. You decide 25 cents isn't worth losing the first two layers of skin cells.
Oh, yeah.
So,
Yeah. Third degree
anyway,
burns. Yeah. We don't
yeah, right.
want that. And is it quite, I mean, is it quite popular even with the locals, or is it mainly like a tourism type thing?
It's mostly a tourism attraction. The people who I my family moved here in 1976, and I moved away after I graduated from college. But the people when you live here, it's where you take your friends who visit. But otherwise, you just kind of live your life around the high school or whatnot.
That's pretty cool. I mean, so you mentioned there, a little bit about your kind of college. So let the listeners know a little bit more about your background. So go all the way back, all
But
the
all the way back. So
way back. All those
I mean,
10
I'm
years, Tom,
61,
all
so
those
that can take a
10 years.
little bit, but we'll move fast across the earliest days.
Okay.
But I was born out in Phoenix, Arizona, in the desert, wandered around. My father worked for the Department of Agriculture, which is a department now I think is kind of under fire from some electronic car manufacturing employee. But
Okay.
anyway, he's long since retired, and we ended up in Hot Springs, Arkansas as a kid. So in 1982, back as my daughter says, back when the world was all in black and white still,
Yes.
I graduated from high school, went on to college, met the gal who I persuaded to be my wife. We've been married now 38 years in
Wow.
May. And so after we graduated from college, we became part of Arkansas's biggest export crop, which is educated people, and moved to Illinois. I lived in the Chicago area for 13 years. And when I was there, I was in the financial service world. I worked at stock exchanges, selling, designing and selling and implementing stock exchange automation software around the world. Started a software company in 1998, I think, that specialized in high-speed trading algorithms. Sold that company in 2002. Got about 30 patents around the world on how you handle high-speed trading, which sounds impressive, except if you know the way patents work, as soon as you publish your patent, somebody who's like 30 times smarter than you are reads and says, "That's a good start. But if I added this, now I'd really have something." So what you're really doing is you're publishing the blueprint for the people who are going to do better than you did with it. So in 2007, I thought, well, I've had enough of this. What's real similar to software? I know, I'll go to law school. And
Okay.
so that's what I did. And after that, became a family law attorney, which is what I do today.
And in terms of the decision to go from, say, the techie side, onto the law side. What influenced all of that? Was there like a little light bulb moment you kind of went, oh, I want to change the world for the better, or did you see something that kind of made your decision go towards that direction?
So I have tried to retroactively construct an inspiring story about that. But the fact is that when I first went to college, when I got out, I wanted to go to law school, but we just didn't have the money to do that. I didn't know about loans and grants and that kind of thing. So I said, well, let me go get in the work world. And I know kind of how to program computers. So let me go do that. But after having done that for, I don't know, 20, 21 years, I thought, well, now you've made a couple of dimes and you can afford to do what you want. Let's try that law school thing again. So I just incrementally went after it. In the United States, before you start law school, you take a standardized test called the LSAT. So I thought, let me take the LSAT. And if I get a really good score on it, I'll take the next step. And if I don't, I mean, I've got a working business, I'll do that. So I got a good score on the LSAT. And I thought, well, let me see if I can get into a law school. So I applied and I got into one. And I thought, well, let me see if I can do the commute because it was quite a ways away from where I lived. I'm like, well, I can do the commute. I'm like, well, let me try to do a semester. And you just kind of incrementally go through it. And then when I got out, I thought, I really like people. I like dealing with people. So if you're going to be in the legal world and you want to deal with people, you're going to be probably representing or prosecuting criminals, which is just kind of a factory. I don't have any philosophical problem with representing criminals or prosecuting criminals, just but it's factory work.
Right.
Or you can do what we call family law here, or some people call it matrimonial law, where you try to help families resolve the disputes that have arisen between husbands and wives and moms and dads. And so that's what I do now. And the thing that I like most about it now, besides helping families resolve their disputes peaceably, is I brought that techie stuff with me. And so I've been working a lot in seeing about the apt application of artificial intelligence and helping us deliver better services faster and at a lower cost.
So, if you take it back, just anybody that's wanting to get into law or family law, what did you said a couple of times a good score. What's a good score?
I think now that I look back, I think maybe 180 was the maximum score you can get. I think there's four sections to it. One of the sections is experimental, so it doesn't count, but you don't know which one that is. So you got to
Right.
go ahead and do your best on all of them. Have you ever seen those puzzles where they say, like the red monkey ate his lunch after the blue monkey? The blue monkey was in the cage at the bottom of the stack. And you got this little matrix you got to fill in, which monkey ate what and was in which cage. They call those logic problems. There's a section on the LSAT that looks like logic problems. It's not, it won't be as flippant as monkeys eating bananas and wearing collars, but that's what it is.
Right.
And that's the section that I, if you make one mistake, you're going to miss three questions in a row. So on that section of the LSAT, I made a couple of mistakes. Other than that, I got a perfect score throughout because the idea on the LSAT, unlike the test to get into medical school, which will test your specific knowledge in chemistry and anatomy and those sorts of things, all they're trying to test in law school is do you have the capacity to think?
Right.
So if you just kind of calm down and read the questions, it'll say, Tom wants to do so and so. David doesn't agree for these reasons. What's Tom's best counter argument? It'll give you like four options. And you just kind of think it through like, well, if I said this, Dave was going to say, well, no, that's not true because, okay, well, this is the best counter argument. You just kind of calm down and think through them. You can get a pretty good score without having to do a lot of work.
And was that a natural process, Tom, or did you have to study? I mean, did you have to practice it to get these exams, kind of the thought process in which you
Well,
were trying to.
I didn't
Right.
study. Studying has never been something I thought was something I could dedicate myself to. I've tried to study before, but you get into college, like, okay, this semester, we're not going to have the end of the semester panic like we did last year, so we're going to stay on it. And that initiative lasts until the first party of the semester, then it's out the door. And so on the LSAT, I really didn't study. I know a lot of people who do study for it and they'll take practice exams. I think what the practice exams would do for you is if you have testing anxiety. Because if you do a practice exam, at least you're going to see the format of it and the nature of the questions. But I don't think that you could take a lot of practice exams and do better at solving those sorts of problems.
Right, okay. And is it like what we see on our TV box in, objection, overruled? Sustained. I mean, is it like that at all for anybody out
So,
there wanting to kind of get a career into
so we, yeah,
that?
we use those words, but there's a lot less drama behind them. I was actually very surprised at first. So I graduated from law school, got my bar card, but I didn't, where do I sit? Where do I stand? I don't know what to do. Well, in the United States, I think in most countries, the courts are open. So I took my daughter up to her one day and I said, let's just go sit in a courtroom and just see what happens. So there was a trial going on. A guy apparently had been to a party and out in the public, at a party venue, and somehow lost his mind and decided, well, I think I'll just go stab a bunch of people. So he was running through the crowd stabbing people. So that sounds pretty dramatic to me. So here's the prosecutor. So on June 3rd at 8 p.m., did you or did you not have a knife on your person? I'm like, that's how we do this? And that's how we do this. We tend not to be too emotive about it. That's probably a recent development because I do believe that probably 30 or 40 years ago, there was a lot more gotcha and emotive type stuff. But now in our world, it's a fairly technical business where you know that for the judge to give you what you want him to give you, he's got to be able to say, well, these three things are true. So let me start asking questions and showing documents to establish that those three things are true. And once I've done that, I walk away. Or if you're on the other side of it, how do I refute that at least one of those three things is not true? And so you kind of lose the emotion of it. Last week we tried a case, and this is an interesting text I got today, actually, just before we did this meeting, is this guy has serious drinking problem. And he's not going to be around his kid very much anymore because when he has the option of choosing drugs and alcohol or his kid, he chose drugs and alcohol. So I was representing mom. And in my closing statement, I don't remember what I said exactly, but anyway, so I got a text today saying, after so-and-so heard your closing statement, he said it has turned his life around. He goes, all that's true about me. I am not a great person. So he claims he's going to turn his boat around, so we'll see if he really does or not. But in answer to your earlier question about do we say objection, sustain, and all that, that's the vocabulary, but it's a lot less emotive and dramatic.
It's very interesting, actually, because I mean, I have a lot of questions prepared for you, but I don't think I'm going to need them because I think I'm going to be so, how to say, enthused by your by the conversation that it's just going to flow one after another. The reason
Sure.
I'm asking this is because I was watching last week, I think it was Runaway Jury. It was John Cusack, Gene Hackman. There was great cast in it, and the way I was looking at it, I kind of went, no, they can't be doing that, because it was kind of like they were trying to pick the jury so they try and win the case. And then they would look at certain individuals and kind of see their personality, whether they're pretending, whether they're not pretending, whether they can be quite emotional. I mean, does that go on at all, or is this really just, is that hype? I mean,
So it's both.
it's
It
both,
does
right?
go on, and it is hype. We had a jury trial in Southern Texas, a couple of years ago, and the client had a lot of money, so he wanted to do all the things. So we hired the jury consultant to come in, and we set up focus groups. And that was probably one of the most fun things I've ever done in my life. We set up these focus groups and practiced our arguments and practiced the evidence and all that. But I'll tell you what happened to us is after the focus groups came back, so we had three fake juries, if you will, or mock trial juries, if you will. After they deliberated and came back, I went to our client. I'm like, you got to settle. We're going to lose this case. He was a good guy and he was a good man. And I think that he had a meritorious case. But really, what we're asking a jury to do is we've got a child who is well adjusted and doing well in school, and no harm is coming to her. But we want to move her about 500 miles away to live with the other parent, where she has some stepsisters or some half sisters, I'm sorry, and she has a lot of family connections and will probably thrive more. So, when you're talking to a local city, you're telling them, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, your town is such a little dusty hole that we'd like to extricate this kid from you and move him somewhere else. They're like, man, no. So we went through all the effort and we filtered the jury out very carefully and, still lost the jury. In the civil case, you only need to get 10 people to vote for you. And we did. We lost 10 to 2. Mom got 10 votes and we got 2 votes. So that happened. So honestly, most time when you pick a jury, I'm in the family law world. So if I'm representing a mom, I might just ask the jurors, how many of you think that dads routinely get the short end of the stick in the legal system? And everybody who pops up their hand, we try to get rid of them because they're going to come in kind of biased to do whatever dad wants to do. If we're representing a dad, we'll ask questions like, how many people think that dads don't typically carry their weight in terms of parenting? Just some obvious filtering questions that,
Right.
somebody held a gun to your head and said, David, you got to come up with five questions to eliminate people you don't want. You'd probably come up with the same questions, and we do about the same thing.
So is it about, and you don't have to answer this question if you don't want, Tom, is it about winning, irrelevant of the outcome of whether somebody is innocent or guilty?
Well, that's a profound and powerful question. I think people have been grappling with ever since people put on wigs and robes and tried to establish the guilt or innocence or culpability or lack of culpability of somebody. It can start to feel like winning and losing if you're the attorney.
Right.
And I know I feel that sometimes. I'll have a case. I know maybe it won't be the greatest case in the world, and I know the attorney on the other side is a really good attorney, and I just go do the best I can. I don't worry about it too much. But there's times when you have a case, isn't awesome, and the attorney on the other side, is terrible, but your case is so bad, the terrible attorney is going to lose. And
Right.
that still is just going to strike you with like, oh, I can't lose to him. But in the family world, unlike the civil world, where they're arbitrating or not arbitrating, but trying contract disputes, do you owe him this money? Did you trespass on his land? There's black and white, true or false questions. We're often looking at what's the best interest of a child, and there usually just isn't a win. It can feel like a win. If somebody's asking for custody, maybe they'll get that custody, but the other parent's still going to see the kid a lot. And you may be out, hundreds of thousands of dollars to go have that fight. And that's money you could have spent on your child, putting them in college or getting the therapy they need when their parents don't know how to act right with each other. So there's not clear winners and losers, but I can't say that attorneys never feel that kind of that competitive juice coming into play in what motivates them.
It did. It's fascinating to actually listen to this because, I mean, did you ever feel that when you were, say, for example, whether it be a man or a woman, that the other person was actually getting a raw deal? So, no matter how much you were kind of in support of your client, did you ever feel actually, well, this person's actually okay? They're doing their best, and here I am defending this person when
Yeah.
clear to see that this individual is doing their best under the circumstances.
One of my earliest cases, I was representing a mom. Dad was gone out of the picture. I don't know where dad was. He was absolutely out of the picture. I was representing a mom. She was way too young when she had her baby, and she had not grown up at all. And she had the child in bad circumstances, dangerous circumstances. And grandma, had filed for custody of the grandchild. And it was clear to everyone, grandma needed to have custody of this kid, this baby. And it was a baby. It was, maybe it was still crawling. And there was evidence the baby had found pills that mom had spilled during a farm party, a PHARM farm party, and ingested some. So that evidence was out there. And it's one of those cases where the other attorney was just awful. And I remember in the middle of that case going to see my primary care physician. And he knew I'd changed careers. He said, "How's it going?" And I said, "I think I'm going to need therapy. I've got a case I need to lose, but I don't think I can. I think I'm going to win, and that's going to be a tragic outcome for this kid." And so that was a difficult thing to get through. And as luck would have it, and I swear it was luck. We did win the case. Talk about winning and losing. See, was that really a win? I don't know. We got the we got I came in to do a job and was successful in getting that job done, but was the world a better place afterwards? I don't know. But luckily, something happened and mom ended up getting custody a couple years later anyway. And I think the kid's doing well now, but didn't have to end that way. And those can be really hard.
And how do you manage that, Tom? I
Well,
mean, with your experience over the years, but if anybody has kind of gone through something similar you mentioned there, how did you manage that?
so you do two things. One is you remind yourself you didn't create these facts. This is not a problem of your making. So all your whole job is to simply get the court to apply the law to the facts as you present them. And so you don't cheat, you don't lie, You don't unnecessarily object to people bringing in evidence. You just let it be a you know, as fair a fight as it can be, or as fair a battle, so to speak, as it could be. We, you know, often use war metaphors when we're talking about this, but you try to make it a balanced presentation. You don't call grandma, you know, an overreaching shrew. You just say, mom's a good mom, and we've got these statutory presumptions working our side. And then you just tell yourself where the chips fall, they fall. Because at some point, and this isn't just true for law, I think it's true for a lot of people in a lot of large systems. At some point, you have to have confidence in the overall system itself, even if from time to time an individual outcome is a little hard to face or a little hard to accept. You have to believe, if you can, that the overall system generally produces a viable, workable result.
Right. And in a, say, a family law case where you maybe have one side, say, wants visitation rights or maintenance, for example, what does the family law court try to do? I mean, are they more interested in having the child supported financially, or is the relationship with the other parent as important, or a guardian, for example?
Yeah, I think that's a super important question because if you don't practice law, and of course I practice primarily in Texas, so I'm very familiar with the Texas family code. But in the United States, I think the laws aren't, as it regards that philosophical issue, aren't that different. And they completely, not completely, but try to separate the notion between financial support and custody. So, for example, you might say, you know, my wife and I, we split up. We've got a child together. She makes a whole ton of money. I don't make as much money. She works and travels constantly. I'm home. My home is safe. So where would you put this child? Well, what you would do is you'd put the child with the home where there's a parent to take care of her and takes care of her well. And then you have mom write that child support check to help make sure that when the child is with me, that her conditions are safe and she's got enough food to eat and that sort of thing. But in the Texas Family Code, it says the best interest of the child is always of paramount concern. But then that's it. The statute doesn't go on to tell you, well, what is the best interest of the child? They don't tell us what that is. But in Texas, we have a real famous case we talk about. It's called the Holley case, Holley v. Adams. It's spelled Holley, even though I did a whole appellate brief one time spelling it like the Christmas bush. But anyway, in the Holley case, the Supreme Court of Texas said, yeah, I know. We've never defined what best interest of the child is, but here are some non-exclusive factors for the courts to consider in determining best interest. And some of those factors are things such as which parent has demonstrated a commitment to fostering a relationship between the child and the other parent. So if I'm encouraging my child to go see her mom, you know, helping her get Mother's Day gifts, and mom says, look, I got to work this weekend, can we switch weekends? And I'm being cooperative. That's going to look good for me. Whereas if I'm saying, no, nah, we're sticking to the order and you just got to forfeit your time, that's going to look bad. It'll look at things like who was lifting the parenting weight before litigation started. Because a lot of people, not everybody surprisingly, but a lot of parents become super parents once the litigation starts. But what was the parenting responsibilities before the litigation started?
Right.
So the court did give the lower courts some guidance saying, you know, these are the kinds of things to look at for the quality of the child's life and less likely to expose the child to ongoing conflict between the parents. So and then in Texas, the child support is a secondary calculation. You simply look at the gross income of the non-custodial parent, and we run a real simple math formula on it, and then that's the amount of child support. So we do try to divorce those two issues, but you know, quality of life and the amount of financial resource you have available to you are never completely unrelated.
Right. And if for example, have you ever had a client in the past where, you know in your heart of heart, after getting sufficient maintenance, with either parent, you know, they're getting sufficient maintenance, they've actually more than enough, and they still want to go back to get more. I mean, what do you do in that circumstance as a family
So
lawyer?
we, well, so what I do, and I think there's lawyers who practice lots of different ways. Some lawyers we call them door lawyers. They just take any case that comes in the door. We don't have to do that. I work at a really big firm. We've got a lot of business coming in, so we can be a little picky. So when someone comes in and says, I want more child support, or contrary to that, the other one says, I want to pay less. The first question is, if they say, I want to pay less, you say, okay, well, explain to me how that will enhance the child's life by receiving less support. And sometimes there's an answer to that. You know, that sounds like an asinine question, but sometimes they'll say, look, I've lost my job, and if I keep paying at that level, I'm not going to be able to pay, afford the rent on my apartment. And so I don't know where I'm going to be living. So I need to pay a little less in support. So when the child comes to visit me, I've got a safe place to be. Well, that's a legitimate answer. Or I want more maintenance. Let's say, okay, let's at the time that the current order was entered by the court, when the judge signed that current order, it's presumed that that order was in the child's best interest. So if that order was in the child's best interest on that day, what has changed since that day and today to suggest that we need more maintenance here? And sometimes there's good answers to that. The child has become really good at soccer, and we'd like to get the child into some of the club soccer leagues because that's helping them with their they maybe they were an angry child before, and having that way to get their energy out has helped them be more successful in school and their social relationships. They're not maybe an academic superstar, so if they can get really good at soccer, maybe they can get into college and be able to afford it. So sometimes there's good answers to it, and sometimes there's dumb answers, which is he can afford it, so why shouldn't he pay more? Like, well, we're not taking that case because we're just going to lose.
Right.
That's not a justification for more support.
What would you say, throughout your experience again, where you've had these family law cases and the both parents are at each other, they're at each other's throats for years and years and years, and the focus is kind of coming off the child or children, and they're just kind of at it, at it, at it, at it. I mean, what effect have you seen over the years that that can have on the child? And what would you say to those parents?
Well, so what you see in those situations is, you know, when the parents have the means, which in our world they do, but there's lots of families who don't have the means, those children end up in counseling. And I have no problem with counseling, except that there's two things that go on in counseling. First of all, you're telling a, you know, if I go to see a counselor, I know why I'm going. I'm going because I'm having this issue or that issue, and it's me, and I go see him. But if you're a little kid and you wake up one morning and mom or dad says, hey, you're going to go see Miss So-and-so today. Like, who's she? Like, well, she's a counselor. And what's she there for? Well, she's going to help you develop some tool set for dealing with the conflicts you're experiencing in your life. And the kids, how does a kid not somehow pathologize himself, saying, what have I been doing to make you think that I'm broken to the point that I need counseling? So right away, you've got some sort of assumption or presumption that you've loaded into a child's mind. The other thing is they don't get to be a kid anymore when they're at that level of counseling, which is caused by their parents' acrimony. What I like to tell the parents is, if you would quit setting your children on fire, we wouldn't have to hose them down with fire hoses all the time. And that's what the counseling is like, is constantly hosing the kids down with fire hoses. Quit setting them on fire. And you know, sometimes parents can be amenable to that. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes you're dealing with a parent who just maybe they have their own mental health issues, or maybe they're so embroiled in the conflict and just thinking about the win, not about you know, how this is going to play out when their child is 20, 30 years old. They can't listen to you. But sometimes you can tell the parent, you just kind of threaten them. Look, this course of conduct, you're going to look terrible in front of a judge or terrible in front of a jury. In other words, sometimes you can't motivate them about their own children. So, a lot of times you can, but sometimes you can't. Say, look, when we go in front of the jury or go in front of the judge, you're going to look awful for doing this. You're going to have to take a few of the other parents' slights on the chin and not quit setting your children on fire so that when I go to court on your behalf, I don't have to argue about why you've been acting like such a monkey.
Right.
Sometimes that works too.
I mean, it's. I mean, if anybody's listening to this now, I mean, if say there's parent alienation involved, I mean, is that a term to use in the States as well?
It is, and it's overused. So the kind of clinical definition of parental alienation, as at least as we use it in our courts here, is when a child is so estranged from one parent that the favored parent can do no wrong, and the disfavored parent can do no right. And that happens. And that's disgusting when that happens. And the typical response to that, if the court believes that that's exactly what's happened, you generally take the child away from the alienating parent for maybe even 6 months, no contact, till the child can get to see that the alienated parent really isn't the demon that the alienator made them out to be. What's most common is one of two things. Either a parent doesn't really know how to discount normal teenage horribleness. In other words, sometimes the parent will say, my daughter comes over and she's angry all the time, and her face is always in the phone, and her mom's alienated her from me. And I say, well, I'll tell you what we need to do is we need to take typical 13-year-old behavior and subtract that from what you're seeing and see what's left over. And what's left over, we'll try to explain. But a whole bunch of what you're seeing, that's just how these little things are at that age. So we have that. But the parental interference is the biggest thing we see. Like, for example, the kid will come over to see me. Let's say I'm paying child support. Kid will come see me. We're watching TV together. We see some beautiful tennis shoes on TV the kids are after, or some device they want, right? And then and my son says to me, "Hey, Dad, I would love to have those." And instead of me saying, "Yeah, I bet you would," like, right, you can pass almost anything off to a kid and let you get away with it. But no, instead, I decide to say, "I'm paying all my money to your mom. Go ask her. Or if she's remarried that guy that makes so much money, go ask him. He wants to be your dad anyway." And why would I do that to a kid? But that happens. So we would call that parental interference, because then the kid gets home to mom and, like this, mom's like, "What's wrong?" "Dad says he's paying you all the money, and now he can't afford me these tennis shoes. He doesn't know why you won't buy me these shoes." That's really common. And a little harder to deal with, because you've got people who are behaving just this side of the line of being sanctionable by the court. So if they have the means, again, we'll get them into some family counseling maybe. So the family counselor can start saying, to me, "Tom, when you say this to your child," then they'll ask the kid, ask the little kid here, "Marissa, what did you think when your dad said that?" And she's like, "Well, I thought my mom was a real horrible person when he said that." It's like, okay, how'd that make you feel about your mom? And I say, "Tom, do you see what you're doing here when you say that kind of stuff?" And I go, "But it's factually true. I am writing those checks, and she did marry a rich guy." Like, right, but when you share that, did you also tell your daughter about your love life? You tell her about how you cheat at work and nap on the job? No, truth isn't the standard here. You're just trying to be hurtful to your child. So that might take months or even years to get through, but there are ways to try to ameliorate this, what we probably would more properly call parental interference.
And for the say the parent who is being pushed aside and can't contact the child or whatever. What do you suggest to them to kind of if the other parent is trying their best and they just for some unknown reason they don't have contact or they can't get in touch with the child, what do you suggest maybe that they keep the relationship going?
Well, so there's a couple of things to do. And again, we're fortunate enough to represent a lot of clients who have the financial means to do pretty much whatever we can recommend to them. But not everybody can. So let's kind of start at the lower resource level. You try to call your child, the other parent won't pick up the phone, won't let the child call you back. Well, what a lot of parents forget is you can send cards. You can go to your child's school for lunchtime, unless there's some sort of injunction against you. And if there is, there's another problem you need to work through. But you can go to your kid's school for lunch. You can send them a card. The other parent might shred it. I don't know. They might, but they might not. So, try that. Like, try some ways to reach out. Even if that doesn't bring you the fulfillment of a relationship with your child, at least the child knows I wasn't abandoned by my other parent, because that's what it's going to look like, right? If mom shuts me out, mom's not going to tell the kid, "Hey, I shut your dad out because I hate him." They're not going to say that. Dad's just never around, and mom's going to normalize that. And so the child, how children are, they think the whole world revolves around them and that they're the reason for all that is and all that isn't. And so the kid starts thinking, what did I do that my dad won't even try to reach out to me anymore?" And so you tried some of those sorts of things. And then they do turn 18 eventually, which is going to be a long time away if they're three right now. Now, if you've got the resources, you come hire an attorney. And we start saying, we start showing that material and substantial change in circumstances. So remember, I said that the existing order is presumed to have been in the child's best interest. And the circumstances that surrounded that order are considered to be the status quo. So you go back into court and say, you know what, on June 26, 2022, we entered this order. Dad was having regular visitation and regular phone calls to the child, and mom was being permissive with that. Since that time, mom will let any of the phone calls go through, denies dad's periods of possession. And so we've had a material and substantial change in circumstances, and we need to change the custody order. The other thing is you get into place the actual order requiring the other parent to have visitation or have the right to visitation and possession of their child. And if the interfering or even alienating parent doesn't do that, we can sue them for that and put the other parent in jail. And that happens too. If the even in a case where I thought mom had a pretty good defense. Dad would come to the door and the kids are screaming, no, I'm not going to go with dad. I'm not going to go with dad. And mom's like, look, I don't know what else I can do. I handcuffed them, put them back in your car. And if mom had come to me, I'd have probably told her, I think you've done all you can. Well, our firm ended up representing dad and we put the case together and the judge ultimately put mom in jail.
Wow.
Because she said, you should have shoved those kids out the front door of the house and locked the door.
Okay.
And just let them spend the weekend on the front porch of your house because you're enabling their not alienated, but their interfered behaviors. So we've got that tool available to us as well, is putting the other parent in jail for contempt.
That's fascinating. I mean, without no joking aside, but how did you feel? I mean, obviously you wanted to, have a favorable outcome for your client. But when the judge says, sorry, mom, off you go to prison, what how do you feel with that?
I mean, I hate to say it, felt good, but I'll tell you why. It's not like mom interfered, and the first moment, the first day we're in court, she goes off to jail with you. No, in that particular case, the judge said, you know what, this doesn't sound right. You need to start doing something more to get those kids gone. And mom just refused to take the judge's, I mean, it was advice. Judges aren't allowed to give advice when they say, if this persists, you're going to jail. Mom just didn't, I don't think, didn't think the judge would do it to her. So when the judge did, I think mom was pretty surprised. Now she probably, I don't remember, she probably went to jail for a couple of weekends in a row, but I don't know about you. I'm not built for jail.
No, me
So
neither. No.
yeah, if they tell me that, hey, if you don't straighten up, you're going to spend 35 minutes in jail, I will straighten up in that moment. So even, a couple of weekends may not sound too harsh, but I don't know, put yourself there. Seems pretty harsh.
Do you think in that situation, from your experience over the years, do you think the judge was just being cranky and probably had seen enough of this, and she that individual had the judge in a bad day, or would that judge be consistent, or does it depending on the judge?
Everything depends on the judge, but I think the
Yeah.
judges would be pretty consistent on that. And here's the reason. So we have these court orders. So a judge signs a piece of paper and there's an order. Here's what you're supposed to do. We do not, and we don't have, and we don't want enough law enforcement to enforce those court orders. So the only way those court orders, whether it's in family law or civil law or any other part of life, the only way those orders have any power is if most of us consent to follow what we're told to do through those court orders. And so when the judge sees somebody, thumbing their nose at them and defying their court orders, the judge is like, I don't have any other way to make you take me seriously except to take away your freedom for a while. Now that you've seen I'm willing to do that, and by the way, it's kind of medieval because essentially, the story gets out, right? Miss So-and-so went to jail for not letting. It's like having heads on spikes outside of the city gates.
Yeah.
So some other parents see that like, I'm going to stop doing that thing.
Right.
That got Miss Smith put in jail. I'm out. I'm out. I will start putting those kids in their backpacks on the front porch.
Yeah. Off you go to see daddy and mommy. Yeah, you're gonna have a great weekend.
Good luck. Good luck with it.
Yeah.
Because if there's a serious problem at dad's house, mom has recourse. When the kids are over there, there's not enough food. Dad's drunk all the time. He leaves them alone while he goes out with his buddies. If that happens, mom has her options. These are cases where the kids just, I don't know, they just get to a rough age. Mom doesn't encourage the relationship. Remember, that's one of those Holly factors, which parent is encouraging a relationship with the other parent? Mom's not carrying her weight there. And dad may not. Sometimes when the parents split up, you gotta go into sales mode. Behavior you might get away with as a parent when you're living together, when the kids have no options, you may not be able to get away with. For example, I remember my dad loved to watch football. Well, my parents stayed together, still together this day after 100 years of marriage. So if I was bored with my dad watching football, I had no options. That was my household. But if I had a mom who I could run to her house and say, you know what, when I'm at dad's house, he doesn't pay attention to me and I feel unfulfilled and I feel unloved over there. So the parents, in that situation, my dad might have had to learn, when Tom's over, we're gonna have to curtail that football thing a little bit. For no other reason than he's just going to run off and start causing problems with his mom for me.
It's fascinating all the stuff that you're going through. But I mean, what is the or you've been through, but what is the biggest reason why people go to a family court, or the main reason? I mean, other than probably divorce or say maintenance or visitation. But over the years, I'm sure you've listened to a lot of things of why they brought somebody to court. What's been the most prominent kind of reason?
So just in our practice, I would say the bulk of our cases are the aftermath of a divorce or an original custody battle. In other words, somebody came in, they got divorced, and they have orders in place about how they're going to co-parent. Or maybe they weren't married, and we get a custody order put in place, which is essentially the same order about how they're going to co-parent. So we'll have one of those. And then that same family may be back at intervals. The guy I was telling you about earlier who decided he's found the Lord after he heard my closing argument about his behavior. Well, that family had been in court every 2 years because every 2 years he was having difficulties over at his household that were pretty alarming. So there was just continued strange, bad, dangerous behavior over there. But then you just also have the intervals of, we get divorced, we've got a 3-year-old child. So that's one set of facts. And it is true that the fact that the child will age is a built-in fact. So you can't claim that, well, the child was 3 and now the child's 8. So there's a material and substantial change in circumstances because no, that was anticipated that the child would live and get older. But the child's needs change. And maybe one parent can adapt to those needs and the other one can't. And so they end up back in court. I will tell you, the very best attorneys don't go to court very often. The clients come in and they say, whatever the problem is, I'm having this problem with the co-parent. And you talk them into, there's lots of ways you guys can try to say these words and see if this gets you anywhere. Go call this counselor, see if they can help you out. Well, they can't. Fine, we'll file the lawsuit, but let's gather some information. Let's go to mediation and see if a person can kind of help us find peaceful resolution here. And in with my cases, well over 90% of them will settle without ever having to go to court. We get the parents together. Now in family law, we do mediation, unlike on TV. One parent sits in this room over here with their attorney, the other parent sits over there in the room with their attorney, and the mediator goes back and forth. Or sometimes they do that virtually over Zoom. But somebody's trying to give me a call.
Yeah, no
But
worries.
anyway, that way the parents are still in control. They can articulate what has brought them to this impasse and why they had to come to outsiders to solve whatever their problem is. But just through some brainstorming, and they're long days. You start at 9 o'clock, you might go till 9 or 10 o'clock at night. You might go for more than one day. Most of the time it's one day, but it might go to more than one. But that is a way to get your case resolved. Going to court, particularly over a custody battle, the only thing worse than that would be guns and knives on the sidewalk. It's a destructive, because when you go to court, everybody's back into win-lose mentality. Whereas when you're trying to settle things outside of court, either informally or through a mediative process, somebody may still have a win-lose mentality, but you can nuance it and you can give a little here and give a little there. Whereas the judges, they're like McDonald's, they serve millions. So they're not going to put a lot of, they're going to hear your facts, they're going to hear the other parents' facts, and they're pretty much going to give you a cookie cutter solution. And it's not because they don't care, it's just they've got to get through 3,000 cases a year. So they don't have a lot of time to try to figure out your situation. So if you're going to have a custom outcome that works for your life and for your kids, you figure it out outside of the courtroom.
What would you say as bluntly as possible to any, say, parents that have just divorced or separated and are at loggerheads or are arguing with their ex-partners or partners? I mean, to put the priority on the child. What would you say to them? By just saying, look, just relax, take a deep breath, try, as you mentioned, mediation and so on. But what would you bluntly say if you weren't an attorney after all you've seen?
Well, a thing that I've told I read this somewhere. I didn't come up with it on my own, but a thing I was told a lot of people before I was doing law work, and now that I do law work, is that a defining characteristic of intelligence is the ability to distinguish between what is important and what is not. So, yeah, we've got a lot of little irritants in our life, and you may be having a tough day at work, and then somebody says something about the other parent. You decide to focus your bad day on them. Maybe it really wasn't even them, but what you're going to have to do to save your money, to save your preserve your own emotional well-being, and to preserve your child's emotional well-being, is you're going to have to learn to distinguish between that which is important and that which is not. And some examples, you'll hear a parent say, "Well, I don't want him to go to this parent's house because she won't feed him organic food like I do, or non-GMO food like I do, or won't make him go to bed as early as I do." And those are probably legitimate things to like how hard you have to work to take good care of your children and feed them a good diet and get them on a sleep routine. And then you feel like it's getting undone every other weekend at the other parent's house or every weekend at the other parent's house. But a smart person will say, "I wonder how many PhD careers got thwarted because a kid ate genetically modified carrots every other weekend at their dad's house." None, none. This all works out fine. I'm like a time traveler. I've been where you're going and it's fine. So if you can learn to distinguish between that which is important and that which is not, it will, that's not just in family law, right? That's everything. That's driving down the road in traffic and that sort of thing. Learn to make that distinction, which is sort of a complicated way of saying, pick your battles. But if you learn to make that distinction, you say, "You know what? We're not going to fight about that. I'm not going to call a lawyer. I'm not even going to call the other parent. I'm just going to absorb that difference in style and move on." And if the more a person can do that, the less likely they are to be setting their children on fire and having the children in counseling, the less likely they are to fund attorney vacations and that sort of thing. They'll be able to keep their money for themselves, keep their peace of mind, and keep their kids safe.
Is there a statistic out there, a percentage, Tom, of, how many marriages don't work out? And I'm sure there's probably attorneys listening to this right now and say, "Don't say it, don't say it." It's this business.
Well, so what we hear is that in the United States, we hear that 50% of marriages end in divorce. And,
50%.
the number moves around, above, and I don't know if it ever really goes below that. My suspicion is that number is exaggerated because of frequent flyers. In other
Okay.
words, you've got me in a 38-year marriage, and, God willing, it'll be, till death do us part. I'm not capable of doing this on my own. So, I try to behave. But you'll have clients who they get divorced in 1998, get remarried, getting divorced again in 2004, get remarried, getting divorced again in 2012. And so, you got you and me and whoever else over here with these really long-term marriages and this one frequent flyer. So if you count the number of marriages, yeah, 50% of those marriages ended up in divorce. If you count the number of married people, probably the number of married people is a far lower incidence of divorce.
That's fascinating. You mentioned an AI previously. So what about the implementation of AI within the legal system? I mean, benefits, net positives, negatives. What's your opinions and how is it going to look going forward?
So it's definitely going to be a net positive. It's going to completely change the landscape. I was just talking to a group of students at a law school the other night doing a presentation on AI, and I told them, "I can't name a time in the history of humanity when it would be a better time to be getting into the field of law than now." Because with the apt application of AI, they're going to be able to start at a level far higher than any other law school graduate has ever started before. In other words, they're going to have access to tools and expertise that most of us had to spend years learning how to develop that expertise. They're not going to have the life experience, so that still comes with time. The AI is not going to give that to you. But for example, I've been working on a new legal research tool that, well, let me back up a little bit. Have you heard of AI and its hallucinations? That's when these AI models just make up answers. So you might type in something like, "Is it true that the law favors moms in custody battles?" You might type that in, right? And he'll say, yeah, that's true. You say, well, again, you give me some case citations to back that up, because we're always having to get citation, like prove what you say. It is so confident. It'll give you a case citation. You know, Daly versus Montgomery in this reporter in this year said exactly this, made it up, but it looks real.
Right.
The downfall, and there's been some high publicity downfalls, is people rip those results off the printer and submit them to the court. The other side's like, man, I've never heard of the Daly versus Montgomery case. Let me go look that up, find out it doesn't exist. You end up sanctioned and humiliated before the world. So, what I've been working on is what I call this hallucination-free legal research. And I love saying that because it sounds like such a big deal. Actually, it's not that complicated to put together. These law students are going to have access to that. They're going to be able to ask really complicated questions and get correct, well-supported answers without really having to learn as much law as I had to learn to come up with those answers. So I think it's a net positive. The challenges with AI are there's a temptation to just throw everything up there. And in our world, we've got to make sure we're maintaining client confidentiality. You may have heard of stories of authors who've heard of people asking an AI model to write a story about a financial services programmer who became a lawyer. Write a story about that. And so it outlines this plot. And this author says, that's the plot from my novel. And that's the whole copyright problem that you're seeing that the people are suing the AI for. Well, can you imagine if you go to AI and say, hey, I'm going to test out this program I wrote. Give me some fake bank account transaction data to test with it. And all of a sudden, it starts printing off my client's transaction data.
Right.
I mean, you know, license lost, firm sanctioned, reputation gone down the toilet. At the age of 61, find a new industry to work in because you're done. So there are some dangers that people have to learn how to be vigilant. They have to learn how to be responsible, and they have to learn how to keep a human in the loop is a concept we talk about. Make sure that you're not just throwing the problem to the AI, then whatever answer it gives you, run off to the court with it. Keep yourself in the middle as the agent of sanity while this technology develops. But I think it's a net positive all the way around.
So how then, I'm actually being nosy at your website, marriagedocs.stores. I mean, how does that integrate? I mean, is that information going to, with AI, are you going to implement that into your, how do you say, your further work going forward?
Yeah, so yeah, that's sort of an experimental website I've been working on. So the idea, so there's two things that work here, right? So the attorneys, you know, we're in a business, and so we want to keep that business going. But we also recognize there's a lot of people who need quality legal services, and they will never be our clients because they just simply can't afford it. And so, you know, the traditional answer is, well, if you need quality legal service and you can't afford it, you don't get it. Well, you know, I think there's a moral issue there. So how do we help those folks out without eviscerating our own business? Well, as it turns out, well, we've been running this experiment for about 100 years. People always find something to fight about. So our business is secure. We can help people help themselves and not compromise the rest of the business we get. So what I was trying to do through that website, and we're just slowly putting the tools out there, and we don't even have a revenue model for it yet. There's a lot of things to think through, is that boyfriend and girlfriend, right? So girlfriend owns a house, boyfriend moves in, she wants him out, can't get him out, needs to evict him. Well, you know, does she really need to hire an attorney to do an eviction process for her? I mean, if she's got the money, why not? I mean, we're just kind of like any other household staff. You give us the money, we'll go take care of an unsavory task for you. But what if she can't?
Right.
So that was the idea, is to take some of these simple things that people need that have to be done right and use the AI in the background. Because, so it's more than just filling out a form. That's been around for a long, long time. The idea about where the AI enhancement comes in is you come into it and you just explain your problem as if you were talking to an attorney
Right.
instead of having to figure out how to fill in a form with the exact right terminology. So you explain the problem. This is what's been happening in my life. And the AI puts together and says, oh, sounds like you've got a boyfriend. His name is John. He moved in on this date. He needs to move out. And here's the proper eviction formulation for you. Another common problem that people have is family violence protective orders.
Right.
So you've got, I mean, can you imagine more exigent need for legal services than somebody's, you know, shooting guns at you or being violent or beating one of your kids? Again, if you got the means, you go hire an attorney and we get it taken care of. And it's really not that hard for a lawyer to do. It's really hard for individuals. I used to sit in the courthouse and you would see a self-represented person show up with the little paperwork they filled out for just for a family violence protective order, and they just didn't do it right. They had a meritorious cause and bad stuff was going down, but they just couldn't get the paperwork right. And so, the family violence protective order, a judge is going to really lean on somebody's constitutional rights without giving them a chance to tell their side of the story for a while. So you got to get it right because there's two sets of legal duties going on there. So, I tried back in the day to try to make forms people could fill out. They still can't articulate it properly. The great thing about the AI is it's a semantic understanding of even not very well articulated stories. So you can prompt a user to say, I need a family violence protective order. Tell me what happened. Just blather it out there. You don't have to think it through. Don't even have to tell it chronologically. Just tell me what happened. And then you prompt the AI, say, after you get the person's story, if there's any questions that you have remaining, ask those questions. So the AI will generate its own follow-up questions. Like you said, so-and-so came at you with a gun. What date was that? Like, oh, okay, you type in the date. So the AI knows what it doesn't know, and it'll prompt the user for that. And then you tell it, okay, now that you have all the data, fill out this form. And it does it. And it's amazingly simple to put that stuff together. The difficult part is kind of the part that's always difficult with user-based systems is, the malicious actor doesn't come in and take your system down. But in just in terms of getting the AI to do the thing I just described, so I've been working with technology since, early 1980s. It never occurred to me that for free I would have access to a computer system that could have that level of intelligence. It just, I could not have imagined in my wildest dreams that would ever be true. And it is true now. And the thing I was telling these law school students the other night is, this is the worst it's ever going to be. This amazing stuff we have access to now, it's only going to get better.
And what was the reaction?
Well, they're law school students taking an evening course. So they're, the three people who sit right in the front of the classroom, they're nodding appreciatively, and the rest of them are probably texting and doing email and that sort of thing. You just, yeah, you have to be realistic when you're talking to students about your impact.
Do you think will this speed up the admin time when you're dealing with these kind of? I mean, look on the website now; it has prenuptial agreements, property, postnuptial agreements. I mean, will you get involved in things like wills and so on?
Yes. So I think on the admin side is where it's really going to have the quickest hits. I had a paralegal today. She said, read my email, go look at my email. So I went and looked at her email. And there's a thing that we do in divorce cases. We have to divide property, right? And so one of the first things we do in dividing property is you got to identify the property. So we create a thing we call an inventory and appraisement. That's our official word for it. And it's a long document that has a whole lot of details about each piece of property, whether it's a financial account or a piece of land or what have you, that the people own and all their debts. And it asks detailed questions. So, for example, let's say you have a retirement account, it's going to know who's the custodian of the retirement account? What's the retirement account number? What's their address? Just everything you'd ever want to know about that retirement account. It's all in a statement. So the way you normally do it is you get the statement and then you kind of go back and forth and you type it back in. And it takes time. And as you know, transferring information is always error prone. So it also introduces errors. So the paralegal today, she was so excited and I was so gratified because we'd just done a bunch of training on AI in our firm. She swiped the questions that we have to fill in for the inventory about a retirement account. And she swiped the account statement. She redacted the party's name and she redacted the first part of the account number. So it was anonymized. And she uploaded that front page and she pasted in those questions and asked the model, I have to fill out this form from the attached statement, fill it out for me. Pow, there it all was. She swiped that, pasted into the inventory. So, what did that save her? It saved her 5 minutes. But you think about, a lot of our clients will have 20 accounts. So now you've saved an hour and a half. Well, if you're billing at a, say $200 an hour to make the math easy, you just save somebody $300. And you start multiplying that over the number of clients that you have, you may be able to save people a tremendous amount of money. So what's in it for the attorneys? Like, why would we want to do that? If we're gonna be, well, here's what's in it for us. We can handle a higher volume of cases without a concomitant increase in overhead. In other words, the same paralegal, maybe she could do one inventory a day. Maybe now she can do two. So I can take on the added business, and the same overhead investment I have is able to cover that additional business. So we have what I was telling you earlier, higher accuracy, better service, Lower price.
What do you think of the industry going forward, Tom? I mean, even with the introduction of AI, and I know we're kind of just at the tip at the moment, we haven't really gone so deep into it. As technology advances, obviously it's going to get, quicker and quicker and more efficient. What do you see in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, what I see in the next 5 or 10 years is a very useful confluence of traditional quantitative, spreadsheet, say, oriented data, column and row type data, and the AI's ability to analyze that
Right.
and help you find insights that you might not have found before. And so we see that in medical research, but in the legal world, where we're starting to experiment with it is where we can upload transaction data from a whole bunch of different accounts all at once and tell the AI to go through it and look for what might be financially abusive spending patterns or what might be indicative of people hiding money. Like there's some really simple things that people do. Think of this. Somebody is going to hide a little bit of money. So what they do is they do a whole bunch of purchases and they get a little bit of cash back on each one of those purchases. If the purchase is $20, they put swipe their credit card for 60 and put 40 in their pocket.
Right.
Okay, so all you see on the statement is Target, Walmart, wherever they were buying the money or spend the money. But the amount that they're taking on each transaction is so small. Is it really worth it to pay a legal assistant or a paralegal or even an attorney to go through all those statements and find all those little transactions? No, probably not. But we can throw all those transactions at the AI, and it can, in a matter of, I mean, it gets faster and faster. But now, say in a minute, and it's only going to get faster, it can come back and say, "I've analyzed 20,000 transactions, and no, haven't found any transfers to accounts." Or, yeah, I've identified the following previously undisclosed accounts. Because of the disclosed accounts, we see transfers to these undisclosed accounts. And so we have the kind of the traditional row and column data being analyzed by this artificial intelligence, and we got the human in the middle who's able to cleanly articulate what the AI should be doing with this data. I think you're going to see greater insights as to what's going on, and cleaner causes of action, better supported cases, and people maybe even walking away from claims that are no good because you're able to analyze so much data and you realize there's not a claim there and you can walk away from it. So it's that merging that I see as being kind of the next big step.
Do you think anything down the road probably sounds very futuristic, but do you ever think, we get to the level where the AI will make the final decision of the judge? So, you input all the information, the opposite side inputs all the information, you press enter, and there's no emotion whatsoever from AI, and the AI goes, okay, this is what we're gonna do.
This is what we're going to do. So, right now, that's beyond my imagination. But to say that something that's beyond my imagination can't exist is kind of self-limiting. But I'll tell you some examples about why I think that's a long ways off. I remember that in the court systems in some jurisdictions in the United States, it wasn't necessarily AI as we think about it today with this generative AI, the ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini type stuff, but it was a different kind of mathematical modeling. The prosecutors would put in a whole bunch of data about defendants, and the system would process that and give the judge a recommendation on whether the judge should let the person out on bail.
Right.
And the idea was if somebody had statistically high likelihood of recidivism or reoffending while they're out on bail, keep them in jail. And if they've got a low likelihood, let them go, but put them out
Okay.
on bail. All right. Well, you and I might be able to look at something. We might be able to look at an application to see that we're asking for people's names or address, ethnic identity, gender, all sorts of things, right? And we're looking for recidivism patterns. We're attuned, I think, well enough to say, okay, I'm not going to look at ethnic identity as a predictor of recidivism. But these AI mathematical models, they don't know how to do that unless you've told them how to do it. In other words, if you ask an AI right now, what's the best weapon that I should grab if I'm going to go fight a war? The way the mathematical models work, it should tell you spears and stone axes, because most wars in the history of humanity have been fought with stone axes and spears, which of course is a completely wrong answer. So they put in all this data and they found that it was heavily racially biased,
Right.
and that black defendants and Hispanic defendants were constantly being put back in jail, no opportunity for bail, and the white defendants were being let out on bail. Well, that's because they had such a high incarceration rate anyway because of their policing practices. But the data came into the AI said, look, I've got 90 people who identify this way ethnically have committed a crime while they're out, and the few white people didn't. So obviously blackness is a predictor of recidivism. Well, that's insane. And so that system had to get thrown out. And I was thinking the other day when we were doing one of these custody trials, you know, the client was asking me, you know, he says all the right words. How's he not going to convince the judge? I said, you know what? That's why we still have judges and not computer models. Because even though he utters the right words, there's something about this guy that didn't write.
Right.
And a fellow human right now is able to discern that. You know, some of us do it well, some of us do it not as well. My wife's amazing at it. I'm slow at it. But you know, people have different degrees of proficiency with that. But still, there's this inarticulable thing that we can sense at each other to see this isn't quite right. And I don't know how, if we can't articulate what that is, I don't know how we model it so that an AI can do it better and more efficiently. So I think the human in the loop, in my imagination, and having watched what I've watched, the human in the loop will have value for a long, long time.
Can I ask you then, Tom, like before we go, what does a future hold for you now? What's the future dreams or goals? I mean, you did shift from one career, pivoted to a different career. Do you have anything else, or are you still happy to progress within the industry that you're in?
Well, so I'm happy progressing in the industry that I'm in, but you know, I'm 61, which that's not old, right? I should
No.
have at least another 30 years of life left in me. But you know, when someone talks about, you know, I can be effective at calming clients down. Well, why is that? Because I spent 40 years making people so enraged that I now know just don't do those things anymore and you will calm people down. So I see the younger people in the firm, and they're so bright and they're so energetic, and the future absolutely belongs to them. If I can help organize some of these tools and new methods of doing business and whatnot, so that the people that I'm working with now, some of these younger people, they're going to be the ones who continue to dominate the industry deep into their 60s and 70s. That's what I'm committed to doing now. And I enjoy doing that, you know, 6 out of 7 days a week. Anybody who says they love it 7 out of 7 days is either delusional
They're
or
lying. They should
lying.
be in court.
It should be, exactly right. It should be in an iron cage hanging from a ceiling somewhere.
That's
But
the thing.
that's really my commitment now is I'm in a good place in life. I love the thing that I'm doing, and I adore the people, and I respect the people that I work with every day. And if I can take what I've learned and what I'm working on in terms of innovations to position them better for a better and more powerful future, I'm going to call that my last win.
I'll tell you something, Tom. I'll be if I need you in the future, you'll be my attorney. It's I think stereotypically when you have this picture in your head of an attorney, you kind of in my own stereotype, you know, obviously based on what we see on television and all this type of stuff, it's kind of non-approachable, non-conversational, non-open, and you're the total opposite in the last hour. So that's a credit to you. So yeah, just have my
Thank
number on
you.
standby just in case I need you in the future. So where can listeners get in touch with you?
So the easiest way to find me is at thomasjdaily.com. That has a that's the little blog I keep that where I have an idea and I share it with the world. But it's also got a link to my website, my firm's website, which is koonsfuller.com, KOONS Fuller.com. And that's the best place to find me.
Are you on all the typical social media on the LinkedIns and the Instagrams and Facebooks?
So I am, but not really in a professional capacity. I'm really a cat video watcher and that sort of thing. So that's the old school part of me. Still, the best place to find me is at my terrestrial address through a traditional website.
No, well, it's been a joy to chat today, Tom. So thanks so much to Tom Daly for chatting today on the Wellbeing Group podcast. Once the podcast has been approved, it'll be released on all social media channels. So thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, sir. I've had a good time.
My pleasure.